Hello and welcome to our latest Charity Digital podcast. I am Lisa and I will be your host for today. We're very fortunate to partner with the National Cybersecurity Center for a number of years now. They help us provide cybersecurity guidance and tips to you, our charity audience, so that you are better equipped and cyber aware. For those of you who are regular listeners, you'll be probably aware that an alarming statistic, which was 44% of charities aren't protecting themselves for cyber attacks because they simply don't see themselves at risk, and that's leaving them very, very vulnerable. Unfortunately, many of us, you know, including us at Charity Digital, are working remotely, and we're even more vulnerable to cyber threats and attack, which can seriously impact the way we're able to deliver our mission. We're having a great panel today. I'm joined by Michaela Liavog from Ireland, who through her extensive experience as Head of Information, Governance and Security at Marie Curie, will be able to offer us some charity leaders' perspective. Hello, Michaela.
Hello, thanks very much for having me back again. Lovely to be here.
Lovely. We also have Claire Paris, who's Strategic Communication Manager at the Charity Commission. She's an expert on fraud and financial crime, cyber crime, and more broadly on trustee governance. Hello, Claire.
Hello, great to be here. Thank you very much.
Very nice to welcome you. And obviously we have CUB, our non-profit lead at the National Cybersecurity Centre, who many of you should be familiar with by now, and who is an expert in cybersecurity guidance for non-profits. Hello, CUB.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the three of you. I hope you're all well and had it's almost the end of the week. Hope you have a good week so far.
Not bad. Bit cold, I'll be honest. It was freezing when I went outside this morning, but it, you know, tucked up here in my office at home, it's nice and warm now.
So lovely. Yeah, have you had a chance to go into the snow for a bit of a walk, any of you?
We've not had any snow, really. Yeah. We had like a few flakes, but that was about it, really.
Same here, very thin covering.
Yeah. Just yes. A scattering. Nice to see.
Yes, nice to see. Very almost Christmas-like, even though we're in February. they're brilliant. Today, really, about cybersecurity, obviously charities have historically provided an attractive target for cyber criminals. And despite this, many charity leaders are still not considering themselves at risk or have prioritized putting resources into other areas at the expense of cybersecurity. At Charity Digital, our data suggests that interest in cybersecurity among charities has actually dropped over the past few months. But the risk to charities in this time has only increased. So why aren't more charity leaders prioritizing cybersecurity? That's one of the questions we try to answer during the first half of these podcasts. And then, you know, towards the end, we'll be bringing a bit of a silver lining and explaining, you know, what charities should be doing and obviously what the benefits you can get by being more proactive when it comes to cybersecurity. To start with, be good to have some of your thoughts about the main reason why it's not being taken, as I said, seriously.
I'm happy to kick off. Mm-hmm. So I think the reason for the drop we've seen in the past month is most likely a direct result of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think prior to the pandemic, you know, we knew that it was the awareness levels that wasn't there with cybersecurity. Now I don't think that's the case. I think it's very much about, you know, when you look at the risk register for charities now, right up there, it's going to be the fundraising income. How do we generate that? And then also the health and well-being of our staff, especially now a lot of them will be working from home as well. But depending on the nature of the charity, you might actually be dealing with lots of vulnerable people. So I think when you look at cybersecurity risk against those risks, it's very easy to understand why it's not right up there for lots of people. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I think that's why that's really fallen away in the past few months.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of firefighting, I guess, still being reactive to what's going on. Claire and Cub, you had also other ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I had an interesting call just before Christmas where somebody had sort of said something on the lines of, well, you know, we've been operating like this for whatever it was at that point, 7 months, probably, you know, in terms of people working from home. Surely people have got their head around this by now. And I think for me, that felt like a slightly unfair characterization of where we've all been over the last 7 months. This wasn't, you know, everybody go to home working in March and then stay like that. We've had so many ups and downs. We've had, you know, rises in infection rates. We've had different priorities and people pivoting to need to support all of the different, you know, social causes that charities do. And I think that's placed a really immeasurable burden on charities in particular, you know, also obviously organizations like the NHS and in the private sector as well. But it's meant that those priorities and where people need to focus their time has been constantly shifting during this period. And I don't think we have yet got back to the point where people can say, okay, we know what the next 12 months look like, and therefore we can plan in a sort of coordinated and concerted way. So I think probably, as Michaela said, the last sort of few months and the drop we've seen in people thinking about and prioritizing cybersecurity is as a result of what's, you know, nearly at the point of recording this, a year of living in a pandemic. And I don't think anyone can plan for that really. And I think that is just a byproduct of it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, unfortunately. Claire, you also had some thoughts?
I would agree with what we've just heard so far, actually, in that, of course, charities at the moment are concerned about staff welfare. And a lot of them we know, especially those smaller to medium-sized charities that make up what probably 80% of the sector, are fighting for survival in many ways. So to a lot of those, thinking about protecting their charity and the assets from fraud and cybercrime could seem like a nice, you know, extra, nice to have. But we all know, of course, working as professionals in the sector, that it's not. It's really important. And that's partly why when we ran the fraud awareness campaign joint with the fraud advisory panel last autumn, that we used the supportive tagline "now more than ever" mm-hmm. to try to get across that important message that we understand what you're going through as a regulator. We're here to give you helpful advice and guidance, but you really do need to take those fraud and cyber risks seriously, signposting to some helpful easy steps to take to actually protect themselves, their assets and reputation from harm. Because I think sadly there's also an issue around stigma, in that some charities, especially perhaps those smaller, less resourced and able ones, do still feel a sense of stigma, misunderstanding and shame about the idea of cybersecurity and cybercrime, and in some ways find it perhaps easier to bury heads in the sand and hope that it's something they won't have to deal with until it's too late. But we do know, interestingly, that from the research that we did at the Commission over a year ago into attitudes across the sector into cybersecurity, that most charities out there of all sizes, so it was nearly 60%, felt that cybercrime was a major and growing risk to the charity sector. But that what we found was that there's this gap between the perception of that risk and the reality. So on the ground, they're perhaps not sure what to actually do about this. You know, what practical steps can really be taken to protect themselves? Mm-hmm. So it's this disconnect that I think we're very aware of at the Commission now, and our partners are, and really trying to tackle.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, because you you made a really good point. Like small and medium-sized charities, like you said, that are still in firefighting mode. So obviously, some of them might think that cybersecurity is a luxury, something that only large organizations can really, take on board and really implement. And Michaela, you had obviously some thoughts about that.
Well, I was just wondering, yes, it's difficult for small organizations to perhaps know what to do, but I wonder if also over the past months we've seen a huge increase again of breaches on TV, the whole SolarWinds and the supply assurance tax, and people seeing governments taken down. So I wonder if it's also some of them are thinking, well, if they can't protect themselves, how can we? Mm. And I think perhaps they don't realise that actually as a smaller charity, it's a lot easier to protect than a large organisation. So I think maybe there's an element of that in it. I don't know, Cub, if you've seen that.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely an element of, I'm not sure I call it fatalism, but it's something along those lines where, as Michaela said, you see some enormous organizations suffering quite substantial breaches that end up all over the front page of the newspapers. And it has a sort of slightly disheartening effect on people. And I think that will reduce people's, particularly in smaller charities, where they're having to weigh up fundamentally cybersecurity at all versus, prioritizing other areas. That will cause them to think, well, what's the point? Frankly. And I also think there is an element of, as Claire kind of alluded to, charities are aware of the risk. 60-odd% yep. said they were aware of the risk, but that doesn't translate into the number of organizations taking action. And I think that's not unique to cybersecurity. That is unique to all risk management. I don't know whether it's still true to today, but there used to be a stat that the vast majority of house alarms were bought after someone was burgled. And that, is a perfect example of the fact that it's not front and center in people's minds until the worst happens. And, we see time and time again, some of the most secure organizations are actually the ones that maybe a year or two had a really substantial breach or a really close shave. And they're the ones that have now gone, actually, this did nearly come knocking on our door. It did knock down our door. We need to take some action off the back of it. And, while obviously we don't want charities to go through that in order to sort of reprioritize in that way, we need to try and make that case to charities now that those preventative measures will be a far lot cheaper than the impact of the breach and then still needing to take those preventative measures to stop it happening again. So I think that's probably where we are now. And I think unless we, move that needle, we're going to be continuing down this kind of road of, awareness but lack of action for a long, long time.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And would you guys say this is a specific to the charity sector, this sort of awareness but not taking action? For some of you who also have some parallels to the corporate world, would you say that there are some similar things happening in other sectors or
I'm happy to sort of jump in there. The National Cybersecurity Centre, we cover all sectors, all parts of the economy and society are covered by our guidance, or at least that's what we're working towards. This is definitely not unique to charities. Small businesses, particularly, there is a lot of synergy between small businesses and smaller charities. In fact, the Small Business Guide and the Small Charity Guide that we've produced are almost carbon copies. They're just contextualized for the circumstances and the governance arrangements in those two particular types of organizations. And the same as kind of Michaela alluded to with incidents such as the SolarWinds breach that's been all over the news. It's a sort of, much bigger, it's the kind of cyber attack that, the movies kind of paint the picture of, rather than something where it's a small scale criminal enterprise. It's happening across the whole suite. That was really heavily affecting government. We see incidents affecting the private sector, whether that's the Marriott hotel chain and their enormous data breach a couple of years back. it's not unique to any one sector or any one size of organization. As sad as this will sound, money is money wherever criminals can get their hands on it. And unfortunately, that means that they don't, it sort of sounds a little bit backwards, they don't discriminate as to whether you're a charity or not. They will unfortunately come after you either way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, though, I would say that there is that unique culture of goodwill and trust that runs through, of course, the charity sector. And that can make so much of the sector more vulnerable to opportunistic attack from fraudsters, you know, cyber scammers. And during COVID, whilst we've seen the same sort of scams occurring, mm-hmm. but with a slightly different COVID-related twist, they are still putting charities and their valuable assets at risk. So no, the sector isn't necessarily any more vulnerable or less vulnerable than other sectors, but that it does have that unique weakness, if you like, which we know can be exploited. And that's something that we try to get across at the Commission in our messaging to charities, that unfortunately, what can make your charity so valuable and helps to, you know, inspire public trust and confidence, that goodwill, the trust, the philanthropy that underpins the sector, can also make it a target.
Make yourself vulnerable. Yes, and yeah, and Michaela, your expertise as a senior leader in a charity. What are your thoughts?
I just wanted to echo very strongly what Claire said. I've certainly found that when you're a charity and you depend on those volunteers, where I used to work, we had double the number of active volunteers as staff, and they don't have contracts. You can't hold them to the same standards as you do employees. And when you then start to think about the fact that, you know, because people volunteer because they, you hope, believe in the cause, they want to do something nice for somebody, but it's also the perfect way into an organisation. And generally, people don't like to think about that insider threat. It's very difficult. And I'd say it's even more difficult in both healthcare and charities than in the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. And Michaela, do you have any, have you had some conversations with other charities about, or examples that come to mind of, obviously that trust that people have and that can be unfortunately.
There are, and I'm sure Claire can talk about this as well, there are unfortunately lots of examples where there are people who have volunteered for a charity, perhaps set up a site pretending to collect for them, those sorts of things. Unfortunately, there's lots of that. And as I say, you can, both Kevin and Claire can probably talk to that as well. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. The problem with sham charities has been around for a long time. It's not necessarily going to go away. And we know that during COVID, there have been plenty of examples of fake charities that have been set up. We're seeing that quite a lot at the moment. Say, you know, fake vaccine sites, etc., and fake emails that are being circulated, taking advantage of unfortunately, public health epidemic, and the insider threats that we mentioned just now, unfortunately isn't going to go away, and does rely upon goodwill and trust that runs through the sector. We know at the Charity Commission, from our internal analysis we've done of serious incident reports that have come in, that the majority of reports of fraud still are of the internal fraud threat, and that may be charity staff and some of them who have dedicated oversight of financial management. And it may be, unfortunately, volunteers, charity managers, those connected with the charity, who unfortunately have seen fit to take advantage of goodwill and trust in their charity and to defraud them of money. And that's something that could well be going on, but we don't have, of course, reliable data on that during COVID, because we know that underreporting, particularly with insider fraud, remains a huge problem because it's so stigmatized.
Yeah, that is quite worrying, but obviously we're also here to kind of bring some kind of solutions or pieces of advice. But my first question would be, what sort of cost-effective actions could small and medium-sized charity take in order to, you know, make sure they have a good degree of security and an affordable price as well?
So, I mean, I think this is really important, and that term sort of cost-effective is vital for small organisations. They're not going to, start taking out significant contracts around security and things like that, because, you know, frankly, that money needs to be spent on delivering their services or you know, whatever it is that their charity does. And I think a lot of organizations have been put off by seemingly significant costs around security, when in fact actually there is an awful lot you can do for free or very low cost, and particularly supported by the free or discounted software licenses that people can get through the Charity Digital Exchange, which has definitely helped in being able to point people to pro bono sort of services and products delivered to them. I would point people at this point to the Cybersecurity Small Charity Guide, which was a joint piece of guidance written by the National Cybersecurity Centre and the Charity Commission. And it's essentially five key actions that all smaller charities should be taking. Now, it's not an exhaustive list. There are obviously, depending on people's risk profiles, some additional things they might want to do on top of it. But it takes people through some fairly actionable steps. So, for example, making sure you've got antivirus deployed on all of your devices. There's free or discounted software licenses available to do that. Making sure you do something as simple as your updates. So when that little pop-up box appears in the bottom right-hand corner that says there are updates available for this system, you don't, as we are all guilty of, click do it later. Yeah. You know, just today on my personal phone, I've had the notification from Apple that the next software update is available. And I think there's, just on that point, there is a little bit of a myth about what those updates do. They are not purely there to rejig the way your icons display on your phone or your laptop, or change the way Facebook looks and things like that. They are there primarily and first and foremost to provide software fixes around security. So where a vulnerability or a problem or a security risk is identified, the developers that have created that will go away, they'll find a way to fix it, and then that's deployed in what's known as a patch or an update. And it literally kind of does as it says. It's a patch. It's like a plaster put over the top of it to fix it. And that will stop people from being vulnerable to that particular risk. So they're free to do updates. They are the easiest thing you can do around your security, but they are fundamental to good security. Just by way of example, and I think this probably comes up every time I do one of these podcasts or webinars, is if you go back to 2017, the WannaCry attack that was widely reported as nearly taking down the NHS, that was because of a vulnerability that was discovered in the Windows operating system, particularly the Windows XP and older versions of Windows, that had been a patch for that had been issued 56 days before the attack started. And therefore that attack was successful on over 300,000 machines worldwide because that patch hadn't been deployed. Now that's a sort of a massive at scale explanation or kind of example of that explanation. But fundamentally, the premise is the same. Putting those patches and updates in place and installing them as soon as they're available is a free and highly effective way of protecting yourself against known vulnerabilities. So there are, of course, other things in the Small Charity Guide that people should do, but those two would be fundamental in my advice to smaller charities.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Kurt, for reminding us of the guide. Michaela, you had some maybe advice as having the charity experience as well?
I just reinforce really what Cub said. You know, the charity guide is excellent, so absolutely do look at that if you haven't before. But I think with the pandemic and the shift for a lot of charities to remote working, the other thing that people should bear in mind is they could do some awareness with their staff around being their own security team. Because, you know, even if you are an organisation big enough to have a team, they're not going to be in everyone's homes. They're not going to know about the security of your home network. So it's on everybody to, you know, do basic things like resetting the password on their router at home, for example, so it's not the default one, and using secure passphrases, enabling multi-factor authentication, basic things like that, that again, covered in the guide, that would really help everybody. But it's, I think, on everyone to take responsibility. You can't depend on somebody else.
Absolutely, yes, yes. Making sure that, you know, the whole team is aware of the risk and knows what to do in case this happens. And obviously, as a whole, I guess, you know, what sort of benefits would you say they are at making cybersecurity the top priority for a charities?
I would say trust.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. If the charity is doing its best to protect itself from harm with improving its cybersecurity and internal controls, then it's going to help overall with its effective governance. Mm. And of course, well-run charities in a healthy sector is going to uphold public trust and confidence in the sector at a time when we know the reputation of charities is all important. And cybersecurity is entirely connected to good governance and a healthy charity sector.
Absolutely. And Kerb, you also had some thoughts as well?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Trust, I think, is the most fundamental thing that good cybersecurity will give people or give organisations. I think the additional thing I would say is there is limited reporting around cybersecurity. So our understanding of the real cost of cybersecurity breaches is limited. So the best data we have comes from a sort of combination of the research that the Charity Commission did sort of 18 months ago, I think now, and the annual cybersecurity breaches survey, which has put the cost of breaches for charities somewhere between £1,500 and about £10,000. Now, that is money that could have gone on frontline services had they not suffered that breach. I think personally, my feeling is those figures are way lower than what is actually true. I think those are almost your real costs, what money actually had to go out the bank to recover from that cybersecurity breach. It hasn't taken into account the loss of productivity of the staff in, you know, being pulled away from frontline roles, potentially not being able to communicate with supporters and beneficiaries. You know, we've seen in the news just sort of in the last couple of weeks prior to this podcast, the Woodland Trust have come out and said they've had a cybersecurity incident, and on their website it says they're no longer able to take they're still not able to take donations now. They've said that this incident first occurred in December and they're still recovering for it. It's now 2 months since that, which has meant for them that's 2 months they haven't been able to take donations online, and I can only imagine that will have a knock-on effect on the income they've been able to generate at a time where already public donations are lower because of the pandemic and the lack of, you know, fundraising events. So there are enormous knock-on effects on the viability of a charity post-breach. Potentially, if it is a really substantial breach, there is the possibility that they may not recover from that. And I think that is something that, as good as Claire kind of alluded to, as good charity governors and trustees, they need to be alive to, and that this is a potentially fundamental risk to the longevity of their charity, and they may fold as a result if they don't take preemptive steps.
Absolutely. Yeah. Claire, Sorry.
It's possibly a difficult message to get across during COVID, of course, but it's the old adage about prevention really is better than cure. And we do know, actually, from our survey that we carried out in 2019, that where charities have suffered a cyber attack, the majority of those, so over two-thirds, then went on to revise their internal controls and put in place better cybersecurity systems, perhaps someone dedicated to cybersecurity, even in a smaller charity, and to improve their training for staff and volunteers. So that acted as a catalyst, but it's unfortunate that, of course, it had to take an attack for those charities that we surveyed to go on to make those improvements that really can be, as Clubber said, now outlined in the Small Charities Guide, really quite simple, basic steps. But unfortunately, we know also that there can be a language barrier with some charities who feel that the language around cybersecurity remains for technical experts only. Mm-hmm. And so that also puts up a bit of a barrier sometimes. So we have to work to ensure that those messages are understandable and that they really are easy steps to take to protect the charity from harm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And part of that effort to make it easy to understand and simple to action is also done with our work with the National Cybersecurity Centre. We've been collaborating very closely and have quite a few now webinars, podcasts and other monthly articles that you know, everybody can access on the Charity Digital website, and we can definitely help organisations secure remote operations, especially that everybody is now working from home, you know, understanding how to make a risk assessment and what to sort of look at when you have a disaster happening or how you can recover from that. So obviously the most important I'd say is really to, you know, to seek guidance and not be afraid of taking a look at resources and having a frank discussion at all level, board level and manager and volunteer level about cybersecurity. So I guess you know, as we're coming towards the end of the podcast, if you had one piece of advice you'd share with you know, with charities that are listening to us, what would it be? Michaela, if you want to start.
Oh, goodness. You're asking one piece. Okay, so if it's just one piece in the current pandemic, I'd say educate your staff to be able to recognise when something's not right and have the confidence to report it. You really need that trust there that they can report it and nothing's going to happen to them. It's just about trying to contain something to protect the charity. So that's the most important thing, recognise and report.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant, thank you. Claire?
I would say to remember that prevention really is better than cure. Check out the Small Charities Guide and try to take some of those simple practical steps to protect your charity from harm now. You'll be surprised, it's much easier than you think.
Absolutely, and much less costly as well.
And free.
And free, exactly, free. How about you, Cub?
I totally support what Claire and Michaela have said. I think those are two absolutely perfect kind of examples of what people should do. I think for me, almost in amalgamating those two things together, is your trustee board needs to be cited, aware, and actually understand the risks. So there is a piece of guidance called the Board Toolkit, which is intended for non-executive directors, trustees, governors, etc., to be able to properly challenge and understand and articulate the direction they want the cybersecurity of the organization to go in. Now, sometimes that is, you know, just a case of making sure that at every trustee meeting, you check that the cybersecurity risks haven't changed, that any cybersecurity incidents are reported up. But that awareness is so important, because otherwise, when something does go wrong, you're going to spend an awful lot more time briefing your trustees on what's gone wrong and why, rather than actually working out what you do to recover from the incident. So please, please, please make your trustees aware. You're not highlighting something bad, you're highlighting something they must know as the trustees responsible for your organisation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all very great insights that we've been able to share today. Thank you very much for making the time to have this conversation with us. Thank you, Michaela, Claire and Cub. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast, and again, please do seek help and do have the conversation. Don't be afraid to have the conversation internally. There are many, many ways that Charity Digital and the NCSC Charity Commission can help your organization. So don't be afraid to have a look. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, lovely to be here.
Thank you. Bye.